Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Tim wraps up our series we called Let Me Tell You a Story as we look at the significance of the town of Shechem. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim.
Have a Bible, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 12. Actually, we're going to be everywhere. We're going to be all over this book today, but we're going to start in Genesis chapter 12. And so I'd love for you to follow along. And we're going to be looking this morning at a city called Shechem. Shechem. Now, pop quiz before we dive in. When I say Shechem, what image comes to your mind? Exactly. That's my point. For years, if you would have said the word Shechem, I'd be like, I think I've read that in the Bible before. I'm pretty sure it's in there somewhere, but I couldn't have told you a story in it. And then even when I did know of a couple stories that took place in Shechem, I didn't know how they were connected. I didn't know what to make of the city Shechem. And so Shechem is one of those places that honestly, as you're going to see, it's throughout the Bible, but like, what do we do with this? It was 3 years ago that we did our Genesis series? I think three, I don't know, time is weird. But my kids were like here, now they're here, so it's like, that's like 3 years. And we did a Genesis series, and I remember getting to this mention of Shechem in Genesis 12 and reading it and thinking, okay, the Bible does not mention a place unless the place matters, and it's mentioning the place, and then it mentioned it again, and then it mentioned it again. And I remember mentally flagging that at the time, thinking, okay, there's a sermon in there somewhere. There is a lesson in there somewhere, but I couldn't figure it out. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't crack it. I couldn't crack the sermon. And then life does what life does, and it gets busy, and you know, you got soccer practice, and then you've got piano lessons and guitar practice for the kids and, you know, work, all the things. And I then got to the spot where we were putting together this series and thinking, okay, let's look at, like, locations and, like, what's in the soil of these locations. And I thought, maybe now is the time I take the Shechem sermon out of, like, dust that thing back off and try to figure out, okay, what is in here? I've been kind of pulling that thing out for 3 years, and maybe it's time to do it, and I'm really glad I did. I actually think that this is a sermon that I needed to write for myself, and I hope it's helpful to some of you, but it was helpful for me to kind of sort through some stuff. Now, if you're just jumping in with us, if you're new with us, we are in the last week of a series that we're calling Let Me Tell You a Story, Tell with One L, and that's intentional. A tell is an artificial mound. You see them throughout the ancient world. It looks just like a mound of dirt, but under that mound of dirt are layers and layers and layers of civilization stacked on top of each other. And the further down you go in the pile of dirt, you get the more modern stuff, and you keep going to the ancient stuff, and they're different eras, different people, different cultures, just kind of stacked on each other. And there's a story in each of those. And then the question is, are those stories connected? Because if you're standing on that ground, it's like standing at Gettysburg, right? You know that the soil beneath you has a story there. And so you go to Gettysburg or Arlington Road, like the cemetery, and you go to these places and it's just, you feel it. You feel the history. And that is true of Shechem of all places. This is true of Shechem. But what is the story in this particular soil? That's what I want to uncover today. Archaeologists spend their lives putting their shovels in the ground, trying to dig through the layers. And so as a church, for one more time, let's put our metaphorical shovel in the ground and let's explore Shechem. What is in Shechem. And there is a story that you probably are familiar with. It's going to happen in the life of Jesus. And knowing the layers of soil beneath that particular, it's like the best story. And knowing the layers beneath that story, I think, make the best story even better. So we'll get there in a little bit. But I want to talk to you about Shechem. And actually, before I do, the last couple of months in particular, I have been reading a couple of books on stillness and silence. And I just had this sense a few months ago that the men in my life that I respect the most always felt like they walked a half step slower. Not like physically always, but like just in terms of how they solved problems. It's like they first were slow. There was like an inner peace to them. And it was like this well, and I'd find myself like when I felt like when I was with them, like they were fully present. And I am not wired that way. I'm wired to like go and go and go and what's the next thing and what's the next adventure. And so I started to like, okay, I wanna mature in this area. I wanna grow in this area. And so over the last couple of months, I've been trying to be unplugged as much as I can, and I'm finding a way to like do that works for my life with little kids and work and all the things. And so I've been going on these long walks without headphones in, which is like, you would have told me that a year ago, and I've been like, you don't listen to anything. But I've just been going for walks with my dog and just kind of listening and thinking and trying to embrace boredom and all of that. And one of the things that's been really obvious to me, and it has always been there, I've known this, I could have told you this, but I think it's become obvious to me, is how loud everything is, like culturally. Like our culture is... You ever feel like everyone is yelling all the time about everything? It's like all caps. Oh, one of the things with this, like for me, is I've been trying to stay unplugged with the news. And so I've been trying to learn my news from other people. So like, they'll be like, hey, have you heard what's going on in Iran? And I can genuinely be like, I actually don't know much about it. Tell me about it. And so I'm learning my news through people, which is dangerous and kind of fun. But like, you know, periodically I'll try to like check in just to make sure I'm somewhat aware so I'm not totally tone deaf on a Sunday and just making sure I know what I'm talking about a little bit. And it just feels like when you unplug just for a minute, we got so used to ever since the iPhone came out in what, 2007, 2009, we just got so used to this. And you unplug for a moment, it just feels like everyone's screaming all the time. Like everything is all caps, all caps, all caps, all caps. You ever felt that? It's like, it's really hard to be silent and like everyone's yelling. Every headline, every newscast, every politician, every expert has a new, like, here's how you be a better dad or a better mom or every family gathering, there's another opinion. And every social media feed, there's another opinion. And everyone has a very loud opinion on what to think. They're convinced they're right about it. They're unwavering in their rightness on it. And they're convinced if you don't think exactly like they think about all of the things that you're not just, well, you're just different. You're dangerous. Like you're the problem. You're what's wrong with the world. Everyone just feels so certain and everything feels so urgent. And it feels like everyone says, okay, you got to pick a side, pick a camp, pick a tribe. It's almost like there's two mountains and there's two different, you know, think politics for a second. There's like two different parties and both are screaming at you. And it's like you're in the middle of these two mountains. And at least this is how I felt. And I've named this here, I have felt politically homeless for a while. And it's like, okay, that mountain, I don't know that I can line up with everything that that mountain's screaming right now, but I'm not ready to go to that mountain yet because I don't know if I buy that mountain. And so I'm just like in the middle trying to sort through it all and thinking, okay, how do I be a good, actually back up, not just a good Christian. How am I a good human in this? Like what do I do in this when everyone is shouting? And it can feel like if you live there too long, I think I'm in good company. I think a number of you are probably in that spot. And if you live in that spot for too long, it can just feel like with everyone shouting, it just feels like a whole lot of noise. And I think that that's why I couldn't crack Shechem for so long. I kept bringing this sermon out and like, okay, maybe there's a sermon here. Put it back in the file. We'll teach something else. But I think the reason I couldn't crack Shechem is because I didn't realize that Shechem isn't just a city. It is a human experience, dressed like a city. It is a human experience. It is what it feels like to stand in the middle and have both sides demand your loyalty and try to figure out which voice do I trust when everyone says, come to my mountain or come to my mountain, and just trying to figure out where is God's voice in the midst of this. So let's look at Shechem. And by the way, you can't, with a story like Shechem, you can't just go to your friends that are pastors and be like, what's your Shechem sermon about? You know, like they don't have a Shechem sermon, so you're kind of stuck. Now, let's start at the beginning, all the way to the bottom of our our tell. We're going to start all the way at layer one, the very first story that takes place at Shechem. If there's any story you know about Shechem in the Old Testament, it's likely this story. We're going to start with a guy by the name of Abraham. Now, Abraham is told by God to leave his home and to travel. And he's going to travel to what God refers to as the land I'm promising you and your ancestors. I'm going to give you land and I'm going to give you kids. You just got to go. So Abraham goes. And as he goes, he has all these experiences, and it's an incredible story. But there's a detail in the story that when God calls him to go, and it has to do with this place Shechem that I had missed before, kind of. Let me read it to you. Genesis chapter 12. So Abram went, this is Abram at this time. He'll be later renamed Abraham. So Abram or Abraham went as the Lord had told him. And they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram traveled throughout the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So Abram built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Stop the story there. So Abraham goes to the promised land, and the first place he stops, the place where God's going to reiterate the promise to him, is a city called Shechem. And I remember reading that thinking the Bible doesn't name drop unless it matters. But why does it matter? And so at that time in our Genesis series, I was like, well, let's talk about the faithfulness of God in this promise, because God is faithful. And that's an amazing lesson that we don't want to lose. Or let's talk about the faithfulness of Abraham. God says go, and he leaves everything and he goes. And the promise doesn't come to him immediately. It takes like 20 years. And that's an amazing lesson on like perseverance and continuing to go. But what do we do with Shechem? What do we do with that little detail? And then you have this detail right after God says, go, I'm going to give you land and kids. This one's easy to read right over. Verse 6. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. And then it says Abram builds an altar. At that time, so God promises, I'm going to give you land and I'm going to give you kids. You just got to go. And so Abram goes. And he gets there, but there are other people already there, and you can't just like knock on someone's door and be like, "Hey, God told me I get your house now," right? They don't like that very much. So this is a problem. There's already people in this land that God said is your land. They have their own kids in those houses that God says is going to be your land. They've already got their own lives in this land. So what do you do when the voice of God says go? God speaks. And it's just a bit more complicated. Life is just a little bit more complicated. What do you do? And in particular, we're gonna have a question asked. How do you hear the voice of God that's gonna be asked throughout history, especially when it comes to the other? The Bible refers to it as this person as the other, the stranger, the person that's different than you, the person that doesn't look like you, doesn't have the same background as you, maybe doesn't even worship the same gods as you. Or the same God as you. Like, what do you do with that person? And there were Canaanites in the land. Abraham, we're told, he builds an altar and he worships God on that ground. Doesn't fight them, doesn't kill them, doesn't like, someday God's gonna get you. No, he builds an altar and worships God. God has spoken and he'll come through on his promise. Now, let me show you Shechem on a map. I think it helps. Two things to know about Shechem. This is Shechem on a map. It's kind of right in the middle of Israel in the mountains. This is Shechem on a map. Two things to know about Shechem. Number one is it sits between two mountains. It looks like they're really far here. They're really not that far apart. But two mountains. On one side, you have Mount Ebal, and on the other side, you have Mount Gerizim. They're both about the same height. They're about 3,000 feet high, and because they sit on both sides of Shechem, Shechem sits in a valley. And because of the mountains on the sides, this valley almost functions, this is point number two, as a crossroads. If you're going to put a road in, you're going to put them in the valleys, not over the mountains. It's just harder that way. So you can see here that you've got a relatively ancient road that cuts from east to west. Harder to go this way, easier to go this way. And so you are to expect that people like Abraham are going to go here because this is where people travel through. Okay, so two things. two mountains, and it sits in the valley. And number two, it's a crossroads city, so you're going to bump into people who are different than you a lot in this city. Okay? Now, that's layer number one in our tell. Let's jump up five layers to the time of Moses, about 500 years later. If you're unfamiliar with Moses, Moses in a snapshot. Moses, tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Pharaoh, let the people go. Doesn't like it. 10 plagues. Wanders the desert with them for 40 years. We're there. Okay, so the end of the 40 years with the Israelites, Moses climbs on a mountain. He knows he's not going to enter the promised land, the land of Canaan. He's not going to get to enter it. So he rallies the people to him and he preaches a sermon. We call that sermon Deuteronomy. And in that sermon, Moses makes it clear. Joshua's going to lead you in, but when you enter the land, here's what I need you to do. I need you to go to Shechem, and I need you to take the nation. 12 tribes, 6 of you, go to Mount Gerizim and climb on the mountain. And 6 of you, go to Mount Ebal and climb on top of the mountain. 6 on one mountain, 6 on the other mountain. And I want you to begin shouting at each other. It's like this youth pastor play. He's like, okay, we're gonna teach a lesson here. So you're gonna climb and you're gonna climb and you're gonna shout at each other. And you gotta do it. You have to do it. Promise me when you enter the land, you're gonna do the shouting match thing. Now, here's what I want you to shout. On Mount Gerizim, oh, by the way, these two mountains, they're almost identical, about 3,000 feet high. However, based on location and kind of how the wind and the rain work, Mount Gerizim is quite green. Mount Ebal is more brown and more arid and more rocky. Okay, so they look very similar, but you have a more Gerizim green, and Ebal is a little more brown. On the green mountain, Moses says, here's what I want you to shout. I want you to shout blessings. And on the brown mountain, Mount Ebal, I want you to shout curses. So it goes like this, he says. Half of you are going to climb Mount Gerizim, and you're going to start shouting things like, if you trust God, God's going to bless you. He's going to bless your kids. He's going to bless your land. He's going to bless your pocketbooks. I don't know why we call them pocketbooks. Your wallet. He's going to bless you. Trust God. God will bless you. Okay, so that's what you're going to shout. The other half, you get to shout the fun stuff. You're going to shout curses. That's what you get to shout. You're going to climb the brown mountain, and from the brown mountain, you're going to shout back at them as they're shouting curses. And if we don't trust God, we'll be cursed. No kids, no land. The enemies will take us over. If we don't welcome the foreigner, God's going to curse us. If we don't stay good on our word, God's going to curse us. Okay, so there's like a whole list of these blessings and curses, and you're going to shout them out. And in the middle, in like a bowl, sits Shechem. And Shechem functions like almost like a natural amphitheater. When you're in Shechem, you can hear both blessings and curses. But here's where it gets complicated, and it's going to get complicated throughout history. From Shechem, it is hard to distinguish what is blessing and what is curse. It is hard to determine what voice to listen to when everyone is screaming all the time. It is especially hard to know what God is trying to say when everyone is screaming all the time. And that I realized, so I had this sermon and I picked it out. And it wasn't until I read this like shouting match moment in Deuteronomy that I realized, oh, that's the sermon. That is the sermon, because that's what it feels like. That's what it feels like. Right now, in our modern day America, it can feel at times like we are standing in Shechem with two mountains shouting. Right? Anybody else feel like our 250th birthday party feels like a birthday party in the middle of a divorce? Right? It's like mom and dad don't get along, and yet we're supposed to be happy. Bring in the clowns. Yeah, it's just like everything's just a little tense, and it's like, and both sides are saying, choose me, and you're trying to figure out, Because that's what it's going to come down to in Shechem is a choice. How are you going to follow God's voice when everyone is shouting? And especially when it comes to what we do with the other side. Okay, layer one is Abraham. Layer number two is a guy by the name of Jacob. Jacob is Abraham's grandson. Jacob is going to go to Shechem, and Jacob is going to go to the very spot that his dad went to, where his dad built the altar. And Jacob is going to go to Shechem, and he is going to build an altar. Same story. He actually buys a little plot of land, but essentially builds an altar. So far, so good. Then it gets complicated. So what do we do with the other? They say we're going to trust God. That's very simple. We're just going to trust God. But then it gets complicated, and Jacob's got a couple kids, a lot of kids actually, but one of his kids goes by the name of Dinah. This is layer three. Dinah, the most tragic story in all of Genesis and arguably the entire Bible. Dinah, it's brutal. It's a brutal, brutal story. Dinah, I'll give you the PG version. Dinah is assaulted, and it's ugly, and it's unfair, and she's assaulted. And now what do we do? It's one thing when there were Canaanites in the land. Let's build an altar and trust the voice of God. But now it got complicated because now she's been assaulted. And she gets assaulted, get this detail, at Shechem by the ruler of Shechem's son who is named Shechem. So Shechem... in Shechem, assaults Dinah. So this detail, there are Canaanites in the land. It seems trivial enough. Move past it. But what do you do when the other wounds you deeply? Wounds your family members, your loved ones. And then we start to see for the first time, like the shouting match lived out in real time. Because on one side, you got Jacob, he's dad. And Jacob realizes what... He doesn't say what happened to my daughter was okay, never once. However, he does recognize that if they try to get vengeance, if they try to fight back, it's not gonna go well for them. It's not gonna go well. Do we risk everything else that we've acquired? All of the other kids, because they outnumber us. So Jacob's worried. And on the other side, you got Dinah's brothers. And Dinah's brothers say, but dad, she's our sister. You know what they did to her? Oh, and you want a detail that makes it worse? Shechem, who assaulted her at Shechem, wants to now marry her. We're just going to hand over her? That ruins her life. We can't let what happened go unpunished. So the brothers say, we got to fight him back. And it gets bloody, and it gets violent. And it gets really ugly, and the story doesn't tell us who's right. It just ends like this. Then Jacob, dad, said to Simeon and Levi, boys, you have brought trouble on me. This is after the violent moment. We are few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household, you, will be destroyed. The brothers' response, but they replied, should he have treated our sister like a prostitute? And then, end scene, story ends. One of the things I love about the Bible is it doesn't tell us how to think. It makes us feel. What do you do? What do you do in this moment? What do you do when the other is your, wounds you deeply? It'd be great. Like, the cliches are always nice, right? Like, we just need to... why can't we all just get along? That's great. I wish that, like, we all wish that would happen, or like coexist. But what, like that, those bumper stickers, like, but what do you do when you've been wounded? How do you respond? Shechem, that's in the layers of soil of Shechem. What do you do when you've been wounded? Now, let's jump up a layer. Layer number four is a guy by the name of Joseph. So we're just kind of actually sliding over. Joseph is brothers with Dinah, kind of like half-brothers with Dinah. And there's two big moments that happen in Shechem to Joseph. Moment number one, and you know both stories. Moment number one, Joseph is on his way to Shechem where his brothers attack him, throw him in a well, and sell him to slave traders off to Egypt. That happens on the way to Shechem. So you can imagine standing at Shechem with the two mountains, blessing and curse. If you're Joseph now, long story short, he climbs the ranks of power, kind of saves Egypt. Essentially, there's a famine in Israel. He's going to save Israel, and the brothers are going to end up coming to him desperate. And if you're Joseph, you can imagine the voices shouting at you what to do. What they did is wrong. That your own brothers, the ones that were so worked up over Dinah, they're the ones who sold you into slavery. They're now hungry and needing you. They don't deserve you. Boundaries, right? This is trauma. All of that. Those are appropriate things. And on the other side, but you could forgive them. You could try. Now, Joseph in that moment is going to choose forgiveness. And story number two in Joseph's life that happens at Shechem is he's going to die. And when he dies, his bones are going to be buried in Shechem. So the very spot that he's on the way to when he's sold into slavery will be the spot where Joseph's bones will reside. Now, that's like a beautiful red bow on the end of a traumatic, traumatic story. It's like, okay, he chose blessing. He chose forgiveness. Will the story continue that way? The answer is no. Moses, layer number five. I'm flying. There's like 16 layers in our Bible. We're going to go through 10 of them. You're welcome. I was so tempted. Trying to get these short was the hardest part of the sermon. Layer number five is Moses. That's a shouting match thing. Like, shout, you on that hill, you on that hill. Layer number six, Joshua is going to enter the promised land. And when Joshua enters the promised land, he's going to reenact the shouting match. They do it. They do the shouting match. That's like Joshua 8. Then they start bowing down to the other gods. And Joshua's like, oh no, that's a problem. So Joshua 24-ish, he calls the people back to Shechem, between the mountains now, where they had shouted. And he stands them in the middle of the amphitheater of Shechem. And this is a speech that they stitch this on a throw pillow and sell it at Hobby Lobby. You know the speech, right? He says to the people, choose this day whom you're going to serve, God or the Baals. Choose life, or are you choosing death? But as for me and my family, we will serve the Lord. That happens at Shechem. That is layer number six. Layer number seven is a guy by the name of Abimelech. Abimelech is Gideon, if you know that name, Gideon's son. Layer number seven, Abimelech is all about power. It's a really good story that we're just going to do like this much of. But Abimelech's all about power. Gideon was a really strong military leader, and the people wanted to make his dad a king. And he said, no, we got to trust God. But Abimelech, when he gets into power, the people say, if you're at all like your dad, we want you to be our king. And a group from Shechem bring him to Shechem, and they declare him to be king. We want you to be our king. And Abimelech likes it. I'll be your king. I'll be a good king. However, Abimelech has 70 brothers. Gideon was busy. He had 70 brothers. And the 70 brothers say, dude, dad didn't get to be king. You shouldn't be king. You're not as good as dad. You don't get to be king. Don't do it. Abimelech's strategy when the brothers say don't do it is he kills them all. Actually, the text tells us he kills them all in one stone. I don't know what that means, but he kills them all in one stone. Everyone except for one person. One guy, one brother gets away. His name is Jotham. Layer number eight, Jotham. Jotham is so angry that you made him, you people of Shechem, you made him king. And Abimelech, what you did to my brothers, Jotham climbs Mount Gerizim. Now, Mount Gerizim, good mountain, blessing mountain, right? He climbs the mountain of blessing and he curses the people and he curses Abimelech, right? He climbed the mountain of blessing and the irony should not get lost. Essentially, his curse is something like, You people of Shechem, I hope you get what you deserve. You want him to be a king? Do you know the man you put in as a king? He's terrible. And I hope you experience the worst of him. You chose him. You wanted him. Now you get to deal with him. Oh, and Abimelech, you're a bad man. You're an evil man. The only thing you ever said that was good was a lie. You didn't believe any of it. You're a terrible man, and I hope you get everything you deserve. Cursed be you, and cursed be you. And he does that from the mountain of blessing. See how the voices in the middle can sometimes be confusing? Because now you got cursing coming from blessing. By the way, this is why this happens every time. Doesn't matter which political party is in place. There is a joke that goes around social media, and it's a dumb joke. So South Harbor shall not repeat this joke on social media, but it goes around every year. Somebody will post, yeah, the Bible says we should, or my pastor in church said we should pray for our president. So I am praying for the president. I'm praying Psalm, whatever, cursed Psalm, about how he may have no children. And it's not a funny joke. It's especially not funny when you know history, because Jotham cursed God. God, would you curse? And then it happens. Shechem is, from this point on, Abimelech, really ugly story. He gets a stone dropped on his head. That's a bad ending. But more than that, the city of Shechem from that point on is going to undergo destruction after destruction after destruction after destruction after destruction, to the point where a nation known as Assyria comes in and obliterates Shechem. They take the women of Shechem and essentially force themselves, and they have babies, and these babies are now half Jewish and half Assyrian, and they call those babies Samaritans. You know that part of the story. That is layer 9. And so now you see, like, what do we do with the other? What do you do if the other wounds you? What if you do with the other's family? Do we bless? Do we curse? And how do we know what the voices are saying? And then we get to layer 9, Jews and Samaritans. And the Jews and the Samaritans hated each other. It was religious, and it was political, and they read the same book. They had the same Bible, and yet they hated each other. They both convinced they read the book right and that the other person read the book wrong. And they looked at each other, and the Jewish people said, our land, you guys have Samaria. Awesome, good land. Good luck with that land. We have Jerusalem. Jerusalem has got the temple. And so we got the spot where God himself lives, on the temple, in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is David's city. So we have that mountain. That's our mountain. You don't get that mountain. You don't get to worship in Jerusalem, you Samaritans. Samaritans said, fine. We don't want your mountain. You know what mountain we have? We've got Gerizim. Remember Abraham? He kind of predates your David guy. Abraham built the first altar right outside of Gerizim. We'll put our temple there. And you Jewish people, you're not allowed in our temple. And then it escalated. The Samaritans spread pig bones all over the temple in Jerusalem. And then the Jewish people killed a bunch of Samaritans. And it escalated. And one side said, our mountain is better. And the other side said, our mountain is better. And one side said, Gerizim. And the other side said, Jerusalem. And then, what do you do with the other? One side said, you're not even other, you're subhuman. You're not even human. And the other side said, subhuman, you're a half-breed. You're not even kind of human. Couple quotes. There is a record in the Mishnah, a collection of Jewish writings, that lay out the clear guidelines for the public cursing of Samaritans in their worship services. Can you imagine that? That wasn't even considered weird. Can you imagine if, like, you are the same God. Jared's doing this piece, and then at the end, he's like, hey, we got to pause real quick. God, would you curse the Samaritans? Curse them. May they never have kids. You are the same. Like, that is 300 Jewish priests at one point, and 300 Jewish rabbis gathered in the temple court in Jerusalem to curse the Samaritans, and I quote, with all of the curses in the Torah. So they went through the Bible, and they're like, okay, every bad thing that could happen, let's find it, and let's say that may that happen to them. May that happen to them. One rabbi, Eleazar, said this. He said, he that eats the bread of the Samaritans is like to one who eats the flesh of swine. Like, if you eat with them, they're not human. Don't eat with them. They're not like us. At one point, Jesus' disciples are passing through Samaria, and they say to Jesus, hey, Jesus, do you want us to call down fire on them? He's like, no. But of course they ask that because they hated each other, and the disciples just assumed Jesus must hate them too. But the irony should not be lost on us. They have the same heritage, the same blood. They come from the same family. They're both descendants of Abraham. They live in the same land. They worship the same God, and they're quoting from the same book. But none of that matters. Logic is out the window. This is politics. Layer number 10, Jesus. John chapter 4, one of the most beautiful passages and stories in the entire Bible, begins with a geographical detail that is loaded. Verse 4, John 4. Now Jesus had to go through Samaria. And pause here. From a strictly geographical standpoint, that's not true. In fact, almost every Jew in Jesus' day went around Samaria. This has got a lot of mountains anyway. It is a direct path. But most of them, if this is Samaria, they went around and into the Rift Valley and down and up from Jericho on. That's Jesus on his last trip does that journey, right? So a number of them did that particular journey. But the text tells us that Jesus had to go through Samaria. Not geographically speaking, that's just not true. So it's like John is trying to tell us something else. Jesus is trying to tell us something else. Why does he have to go through Samaria? He's got to meet somebody. This is like about calling. It's not about geography. This is like a calling thing. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar. Now, that was what it was called at the time of Jesus, but they would have all known what it used to be called. Any guesses? Shechem, Sychar and Shechem, same place. Okay, so he has to go to a town in Samaria called Sychar or Shechem, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Those two names, part of the soil. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. Jacob's well. Coincidence that we name drop Jacob here? This is the same guy that earlier built an altar to God, same territory. And then, in the same location, watched his whole family fall apart. Dinah, his daughter, is assaulted. Joseph is sold off into slavery, all in the same plot of ground, but eventually he'll be buried there. Joseph will. And Jesus comes back here, and he meets it's noon, we're told. And then we read this. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone to the town to buy food. So she's Samaritan. She's a she. She's a woman. In the middle of the day, there's no one with her. Every category of other that you can find, this woman represents it. She's even been othered by the Samaritans, right? She's in the middle of the day, which most women culturally went to get water in the morning when it was a little bit cooler out. So apparently, they know her reputation, we'll learn it in a moment, and they want nothing to do with her either. So she has to go in the middle of the day. She's a woman. If you want TMZ following you, I think, is that still a relevant reference? Like, this is what you do. You talk to a woman in the middle of the day in an enemy territory. The woman will then say the quiet part out loud. The Samaritan woman said to Jesus, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." And that's not wrong. You do not talk to each other. You do not look at each other. You do not eat with each other. And yet Jesus here says, "Would you please give me a drink?" And then what unfolds is it's the longest and most theologically dense conversation in maybe the entire Bible. Jesus talks about how he offers her living water. He talks about eternal life. He talks about how she's had five husbands and now she's living with somebody who's not her husband, knowing that women didn't really have the right to divorce. It was the men who divorced. So you have been a victim five times over, now a sixth time. And Jesus like tells this story back to her. And he still sits down at the well and he still listens and he still offers her water. And then she asks the Shechem question that's been coming up through history. "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshiped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. So our ancestors said Gerizim is the mountain. You say Jerusalem is the mountain. We have our tribe. You have your tribe. We have our culture. You have your culture. We have our group, you have your group. Which group is right? You're a prophet. Which side is right?" That's the question, right? Ever since there were Canaanites in the land, who wins? Verse 21, "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews." So he's not mincing his words on how do we read this book. But he says, "Yet a time is coming and has now come when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit, in the spirit, and in truth." For 2,000 years, that plot of land, the question was asked, which mountain wins? And Jesus' response, neither. Neither. Whether it was Ebal and Gerizim, or it's Gerizim and Jerusalem, or Jew and Samaritan, us or them, the problem for 2,000 years is we have been asking the question, which mountain is right? And Jesus says, neither. In fact, the question that we were supposed to have been asking way back with Abraham is, what is the voice of God saying? Jesus reminds him of that. You will worship God in spirit and in truth. But you lost the question in the shouting. It is possible that in the midst of political shouting in our world or cultural shouting in our world, we forget the mission and lose the question we're always supposed to ask in the first place. This is breathtaking. The woman says, "I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he'll explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking, I am he." And all this happens to the wrong person at the wrong time of the day from the wrong tribe. And Jesus reveals who he is to her. And then she runs back to town. Verse 28, "Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to town and said to the people, 'Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?' And they come. Those half-breeds who live, those other mountain people, the wrong-minded, wrong-thinking people in the Jewish perspective, they come. Now, I tell you 10 layers of history, painful, painful history, hopefully not painful, but 10 layers of history all to make one point. There's way more content in each of those stories, but one point, one big idea that I've been wrestling with, and maybe we can wrestle together. But everyone came to Shechem to win the argument. Everyone came to Shechem to win the argument. Jesus comes to Shechem to meet the person. Jesus focuses on the woman, not on the mountain. Or maybe you could say Jesus focuses on the person and not on the politics. And that is so important. I think it is so easy to forget that we're talking about real humans, real people, real emotions. We can hear a detail about them. Oh, you're part of that mountain. And we can fill in everything we think about them based on the fact that they are from that mountain, that political party, that ethnicity, that socioeconomic population, that religion. And we now know everything about them as though their story is only one layer of soil. And ours is, we know us, like we're formed by layers and layers of soil. But It is really easy to just convince ourselves that everyone is flat and one-dimensional. And in this moment, this woman says, he knows everything about me. He knows every layer beneath my personal story, all the trauma, all the heartache. He told me everything about me. But she doesn't do it in a way that she feels judged. She feels seen. How do we do this? I think people just want to be seen, by the way. I think they want to be seen. I was listening to a podcast about the World Cup because I love the World Cup. It's the only time I watch soccer, but I love it for like a couple of months. I was watching, and they were talking about, you know, because we're hosting it this year, and that's a big deal. And we're going to be hosting it like over our birthday, which is kind of awesome, right? And so like we get to show the world who we are, and that can be awesome. That can be an opportunity. And I was listening to this podcast where they were talking to like people who live in New York and New Jersey, and all of these people are going to be flooding their streets. And this older man in this podcast was talking about how he loves it. He's like, I'm so excited. He goes, I get to see all of these people wearing the flag of their country, singing these songs in our local pubs about their country, and we get to talk. They're going to speak different languages, but we'll get to talk, and we'll get to laugh, and we'll share a pint, he said. And we'll be reminded that we're all part of something bigger. If soccer can do that, isn't that what we were supposed to be doing? There's a passage in Revelation that I've always loved. After this I looked, John says, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, language, standing before the throne, before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. That's a picture of heaven. Every nation, tribe, people, and language. Heaven is like filled with diversity. If we want everyone to speak the same language, we might get really uncomfortable in heaven. If we want everyone to look the same way, I don't see color. Well, you might in heaven, right? And it's apparently an awesome thing. If we're like, we're all supposed to be part of the same tribe, like, well, apparently, like, there's a pride in our tribes that's okay as long as we know how to, in the end, say salvation is from our God. If we focus on the mountains, honestly, focus on the mountains, like, how do we solve the Iranian war right now? That's really complicated. What do we do about Middle East politics? Israel and now Lebanon and Israel and Hamas, like, that's really, really complicated. What do we do? What's not complicated, if you focus on the mountain, but if you focus on the person, here's what we can say for certain. Palestinians are beautiful people. Seriously, you should look at them. They're beautiful people. And Lebanese are beautiful people. And Iranians are beautiful people. And Israelis are beautiful people. And we all bear the spark of our God. And that is not controversial. And if it is, we may have gotten, it may just be an indication that you have gotten sucked into the mountain game. How do we do this? Observation, two observations quickly. Observation number one is Jesus stopped long enough to see her. Disciples run ahead. They got that young energy going for them. But Jesus stops long enough. I do think that is required. Shane Claiborne once said that if you want the world to be a less racist place, start at your dinner table. I've always loved that, right? Like, instead of like trying to solve racism, why don't you just invite somebody who's a different race to your dinner table and have a conversation with them? It requires us to stop long enough. We all have layers and layers. Like, people are fascinating. People are really fascinating. The way they see the world is because of layers of things that they've experienced, just like you, just like me. The way you believe, the way you think about politics, the positions you have on church, all that comes from stuff, right? You may have been hardened by the church from some experience, or politics may have burned you, or maybe it didn't. Maybe you grew up in a faith, maybe you didn't. All of that is part of who we are, and it's if we want mission number one is to help people hear the voice of our God and understand who he is, you have to stop long enough at the well. Everyone's screaming on the mountains, but Jesus is sitting at a well. There's an irony there that I find beautiful. Observation two, notice that Jesus asks her for a drink. It's like the very first thing he does. That's like counterintuitive. He's gonna offer her living water and eternal life, and that's really awesome. And he's got something to offer her too, but the first thing he does is he asks her for water because he's thirsty. And I think that's a missional impulse that we can forget, right? If anyone has a Messiah complex, it's not Jesus, which is ironic because he's the only one who's the Messiah, right? If anyone has a Savior complex, it's not Jesus. Like Jesus comes in, he's like, I'm thirsty. Can I have some water? It is really important when we meet people who are different than us, who are other than us, that we work really, really hard to not steal their dignity. There's a book called When Helping Hurts. It's worth a read, I promise you. When Helping Hurts argues that one of the problems in Christian mission trips is that we can go on mission trips and steal dignity from people as like the white saviors or the American saviors. And we mean well, we're sincere. It's not critiquing that, but we can come and steal dignity from local story. When I was, 16 years ago or so, 17 years ago, I was in another church and I got the opportunity to go to Guatemala where we were gonna build houses. It's a cool mission. And I went with this group. I was actually leading the group. So I went with this group to build houses and I didn't know anything about building, still don't, but I was gonna help build these houses. And so we're building in this little mountain village and it's like a really poor community. And we're building these homes and they're pretty nice. Pretty decent home. I mean, by your standards, by my standards, we wouldn't even put our dog in them, but they're nice homes. That should tell us something about us. They were decent homes, and we're building these homes for these people, and I'm working on this house, and this guy next to me, older gentleman, and he was a builder by trade. He had retired, and so he's showing me how to do it. It's pretty embarrassing to not, you pretend like you know how to swing a hammer when he's like, what if you don't hit your thumb every time. But he's showing me how to do it. And then I noticed that this, like, at that time he felt ancient to me, but he was probably 35. But the guy whose family was gonna move into the house had come back from the fields. And he was, I think he was out working in the fields because he's covered in dirt and he's like he's like been working all day, sweaty, it's been a hot day. And he comes back, and he's got this number of kids, and they've been playing, and his wife is, she's busy because she's got a number of kids who are playing, and so she's being a mom, and we're building this house. And he comes back from the field, and he walks into his house, and he points at a hammer, and he picks it up. And I responded, no, we're here to serve you. Go be with your kids. Have fun. Like, we're here to serve you. In my broken Spanglish, like, that's what I was trying to say. And he laughed. And I thought I was doing the Christian thing. I was sincere in my faith. I thought I was doing the right thing. And a minute or so passes, and this gentleman who was helping me build, this former builder, calls the guy back over, and in his broken Spanish, says, can you show me how to do this? And he points at the hammer, and he's like, Can you teach me how to do this? And the guy shows him how to do it. And the whole time I'm thinking, you're a builder. You know how to do that. Later that night, I asked him about that moment. I was like, hey, why did you ask him for advice on how to do it when you know how to do it? Like, this is your profession. You're really good at it. And he said, I remember this. He said, it felt like the right thing to do. I saw his kids and I realized if it was me, I would want my kids to see me build their house, not some stranger. It wasn't about his knowledge. It was about his missional impulse to say, how do I restore the dignity of this guy? We're coming in and building his house. How do I let him, in front of his own children and wife, restore his dignity? He had a poverty issue, not a work issue. Jesus in that moment starts by saying, can I have some water? He lets her serve him, a Samaritan, a woman in the middle of the day with a reputation. We have layer upon layer upon layer in Shechem, and it's been building. Who is the other? And is what if they wound you? And Jesus, in one brilliant move, says, we're done focusing on the mountains. We're going to focus on the people. While everyone is screaming from the mountain, Jesus is sitting at a well. While Shechem for years has been about winning an argument, Jesus comes to Shechem and sees a person. And that is true for you and me. I have layers to who I am. I still do things where I'm like, ooh, where'd that come from? It's in there somewhere. I'm formed by stuff. So are you. And he knows all of it. And he still sits down. And that's really good news. And that is true of them, whoever they are, however they vote, and however they worship. It is true of them. And Jesus knows everything about them. And she still felt safe enough. And in that, she says, oh, I know who you are. You're the Messiah. If we want people to know Jesus, we may have to leave the mountain game and get out of our own way. We don't have to be right, but we do have to be loving. We're going to take communion this morning because communion is, of all the ways Jesus could say, hey, when you gather, here's a ritual. Jesus gives us communion, which is like the best ritual because it's a meal. And meals are collaborative, and meals require participation, and meals are flat. Like, there's no hierarchy. And so he gives us a meal. And so we believe that at communion, Jesus wants us to remember what he did for us. B, this is a foretaste of eternity where every tribe, language, people, and nation are gathered. But C, he wants us to do this as a community. This is the moments where we put down our own pride and we come to him and we say, we're in this together. The way we do communion here is we take the bread and we'll dip it into the cup and you'll take it individually. Abby Black is back from maternity leave as of today. High five, Abby. She will, you can clap for that. Let's clap for that. Let's go. Abby would love to serve you. If you're unable to make it up, just wave your hand. She'd love to come serve you. And we have a gluten-free option on the very edges. And so if you're looking for a gluten-free option, these two tables over at the edges will have a gluten-free option. These two do not. But as you come, just remember, this is our opportunity to re-tribe our world around Jesus. That's beautiful. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Heavenly Father, I pray that you would inspire us by a vision so large that we want it, and we want it. Lord, every language, tribe, people, and nation singing your salvation, would that be so compelling to us that anything in us that would hold prejudice or would judge or would belittle, Lord, that would be confronted because this is so much better. And Jesus, would we see that in the center of this worship experience is you sitting at a well. And Lord, we are so grateful. And Jesus, we pray this in your name. Amen.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church, we want to wish you a blessed week.